You're listening to Save My City, part of the We Love Where You Live podcast series brought to you by the Michigan Municipal League. Here's your host, Tony Mangini.
Hello, and thanks for joining us again on the Save My City podcast. Happy today to be joined by John Filo of the Sugar Law Center. And John is the lead counsel on the Headley lawsuit that has been making its way through the court. And recently, we had a decision come out of the appellate court. So we're going to talk a little bit about that and maybe what's in store going forward. So thanks for joining us, John.
Well, thanks for having me, Tony. And I really do appreciate this invitation. It's a pretty exciting day here for the Municipal League down in Detroit.
Yeah, so for those of you, we are actually recording live at our convention here in Detroit. So something we don't get to do very often, but always nice to have a chance to do this with folks around. So why don't you, for folks that maybe aren't familiar with this, I know we've talked about it a lot, both on this podcast and outside of this podcast, but maybe give folks a background of what this case is about and why it's so important.
Sure. Yeah, we think this is a tremendously important case. It's one of those issues, though, that just doesn't get, you know, as much media attention as attention that it deserves, much like the issues of local government. You know, we don't really pay attention to what's happening in local government, in popular culture, popular society, until there's a problem, right?
Sad but true.
Yeah. Right? And then it's our local government's fault. But this case arises from the funding of local government. And I think you can see over the past, you know, 10, 20 years, it's really the culmination of what's been happening over time. We saw in the, 2010s, late 2010s, the rise of a number of cities, school districts getting emergency management. I think folks are mistaken, and I think they learn quickly when you talk to them about it, but there's an image that these folks just didn't manage money well. Mm. And I think that's a fallacy. And I think it's proven out in the facts. I think municipal finance people know this well. They've seen a real decline in local governments, the funding streams and the revenue streams. They're being asked and have been asked over 40 years to do more with ever less.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, that is a culmination of problems. What this case is about is a component of that, is the state in Michigan is required to fund local governments at a certain level. That arose out of the Headley Amendment. Mm-hmm. Headley Amendment was an attempt to put a balanced sort of program in place, which capped property taxes, in other words, capped local government's revenue streams. But at the same time, the drafters were savvy enough, were aware enough to say, hey, if we're going to cap your revenues, we also got to make sure you have stable funding for your existing services. That's where they put into the state constitution, it's a constitutional provision, that the state had to maintain funding levels that existed in 1978. In other words, the same percentage of the state budget that was going to local governments then, that same percentage now has to go.
Yeah,
to
local, that's something that I think, you know, most people when they talk about Headley, they understand the rollbacks and other things related to that, but no one really talks about that. And it's really kind of an inside baseball sort of an argument, and even one, if you're aware of it, you kind of shrug your shoulders and say, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" And this case is attempting to do something about that.
Absolutely, it is, and it's, you know, it's really not, it cuts across any political lines. When you say the words Headley, you get strong opinions on both sides.
You sure,
right?
Do. But
those strong opinions are all formed around the idea of the strict property tax limits. Mm-hmm. But that's not the entirety of Headley. Headley did have the other provisions which were requiring maintenance of that funding. And that's what this case is centered around.
So within that broader, you know, explanation, The case basically went forward with sort of three separate points that the royal we here, but that were being argued on behalf of local government, that the state was not applying Headley appropriately under the Constitution. So could you cover those maybe just quickly?
Right. There's three areas in particular where we say that they're not complying with the revenue sharing requirements. Think of it first, there's the pool of money that's supposed to be transferred from state revenue sources to local governments. Well, how you calculate what's going into that pool determines the size of that pool. What we say the state is doing is including certain funding that is not permitted to be included in that total calculation. The first area has to do with Prop A, tax revenue that changed it back in the early 90s, mm-hmm. changed the way schools were funded in Michigan. We don't have any problem with how that Prop A funds schools so much as the inclusion of those monies in the revenue sharing formula.
And so you're referring to the 2 cents, the change from 4 cents to 6 cents in sales tax?
Right.
And those monies being applied. And then essentially, they took credit for that, even though it changed the proportion outside of the, it was a shift, essentially, of how that tax was collected.
Yeah, it was a tax shift because what it did is it said, okay, schools, local school districts can't tax, they cut the amount of property tax they could collect. At the same time, the state said, we will supply that revenue that you lost through that increase in the sales tax. However, what they did at the same time, if they had just done that, replaced the local property taxes with state funding through that increase, that would be fine. But what they did at the same time is then also said, we're going to reduce the amount of revenue sharing that we're presently paying by the same percentage that they had increased state revenue. So you, this local,
and then took credit for it.
And took credit for it. Local districts or local governments took two hits. One, the loss of that property revenue, tax revenue, and then also a loss of the other funds that were being shared.
Interesting. Yeah. And that's something, again, people don't stop to think about, but that's a huge component of this because it does speak to our ability to raise revenues and the state in terms of that proportionality, which is was the key sort of simple, very simple way of looking at this when Hadley passed it. Probably never could have anticipated what the future would hold in terms of these different ways. But and that's what we're fighting about now, and that at least in that one part of it.
It is. But it's funny you say that, too, in terms of it's amazing to me going back and looking at some of the things that were written around the time of Hadley and at the time of passage of Prop A. And many of these problems were actually foreseen. Is like if you're going to do what they were suggesting with Prop A, and at the time everyone agreed that we needed to equalize fundings among the school districts in the state. But Dick Hadley also recognized that, wait, if you're going to do it this way, it's going to be a tax shift if you use it to reduce the revenue sharing, and specifically what was prohibited by the Hadley Amendment. And that's what's occurred. It's interesting, too, because you get back into the history, and a lot of this stuff was talked about and recognized, but there was almost a throw up your hands.
It's
we don't want to make
too big of a hill to climb.
Right. So it put us in, you know, put us in the problems we've having today. The second area that we're challenging the way the state calculates that revenue sharing is the state is calling charter schools local governments, is calling them political subdivisions of the state. I don't think any fair-minded person could consider a charter school, whether you support them or don't support them, that's not the issue. But you can't consider them a political subdivision.
And that's
of
an
the
important
state.
Distinction, right? Because I think people say, well, I love charter schools. My kid goes to a charter school. That's really not what we're talking about. The Constitution was pretty specific that it looked to funding for local governments. And there's no arguing that these in any way, shape, or form are local governments.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, our funding for local governments arises out of Michigan's a strong, has traditionally, for since its inception, been a very strong local government-based state. It, you know, back in 19, I think it was the 1912 Constitution, we were one of the first states to put in home rule and strong home rule. And we preserve that throughout. You know, we recognize the importance of local government. With the charter schools, this isn't about whether you support or against. It's about, do you support your local governments? And if we're going to preserve that, you know, just funding private nonprofit corporations, they shouldn't be sharing in the same pool of money that go to local governments.
No one's questioning whether it's in the state's purview or authority to have these private charter schools. That's perfectly acceptable. It just doesn't count towards the support of local government. At least that's the
that's absolutely right. I think that encapsulates it very well. You know, and we don't say the state can fund charter schools. Mm. You just can't count it as a payment to a local government.
Yep. And so what was the last part of the lawsuit?
The third area is another sort of a you know, one of those people's eyes can glaze over, but when you get, you get it, it's kind of a light bulb goes off. It has to do with an area that, you know, we've heard of in the context of Headley with the funded mandates. There's a provision of Headley that says any new funded mandates or new mandates to local government have to be funded by the state. That means anything after 1978 that imposes costs or responsibilities on local governments, the state has to fund it if they're going to impose that. Well, what the state's doing is counting the funding of those mandates towards their revenue sharing. Now, why that's wrong is because when you go back to Headley, the reason they pegged that maintenance of the certain percentage of state mm-hmm. revenue that has to be shared with local governments, they pegged that percentage because they said, look, we want to continue the existing level of state government. At that proportion. So you have to maintain the revenue sharing at that proportion. Then anything additional you want to impose on local governments, you have to pay them more. Okay? What the state has done is taken out that we have to pay you more portion. And they've been using it to reduce the amount of revenue sharing.
That's pretty
is that clear? Or
yeah, it is. It is. It's kind of like, I'll put it in my terms my son would understand. So I'm giving him money to go pay his grocery bills at school. And I say, you know what? Pay for a car out of that. It's like, wait a second.
That's right.
You know? You only gave me enough to buy the food, you know. Yeah. And that's kind of what they're doing to us. It's an overstep by them. So,
yeah, I think that's a good analogy in that if you have, you know, with your child, if you give them, you know, $5 a week for an allowance and you say, this is your allowance, this is what you're going to have for spending money and, day-to-day living, buying a soft drink at school or whatnot. Well, tonight I want you to run down and get us some milk from the store. And here's $5 to go down and get the gallon of milk or whatnot. But I'm going to reduce your
that counts with your allowance.
Your allowance, right?
We got the attention of kids all over right now. What? Wait, what?
Yes. That's part of the trick of this case is really
breaking it down so people can understand.
Down,
I agree.
You know, and it's a trick for the courts, even with the courts. I mean, the courts are smart and they're sophisticated for the most part. But even still, you need to break it down into very, you know, simple means that people can understand. And as you know, municipal finance is not...
not so simple.
No. It's awful hard. It's a trick to get it to that level.
It really is.
Yep.
So the suit was filed around those 3 points, basically, and we had a decision come down from the appellate court, and we had a win and a loss and a split decision.
Yes. It's like the Lions record,
yeah.
Right? Most years. Yes, we had a clear win on the funded mandates portion. An important component of that win is the state is required by the decision to start keeping track of the funded mandates, maintain a list, and publicly disclose which ones they're counting or doing at all. We haven't had that list. The list is supposed to be tabulated since 1978. It's never been tabulated.
Never been done. So we're a little behind in our homework right now. So.
A little behind. And you do have to wonder, you know, the more nefarious, you know, the more circumspect side of me believes that's intentional. It may also be just the day-to-day of state government. Who's going to do it, when they're going to do it, who knows. That was our win. The split decision came on the charter schools where a majority did find against us, two out of the three judges. But however, one other judge made a strong argument saying that under no circumstances can you consider charter schools a local government. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to note under the charter schools as well that different from other parts of our state constitution, the Headley Amendment specifically defined what are local governments, and it said they're political subdivisions of the state. It included school districts existing at that time because they clearly were. But that political subdivisions of the state, I don't know how you can get...
It's really not subject to interpretation. It's a pretty straightforward definition.
It's pretty straightforward. Charter schools are required by state law to be nonprofit corporations.
But not a political subdivision.
Two different
those things. Are complete, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. The league is a public nonprofit corporation. We are not a political subdivision of the state.
That's a good example. You know. I work for a nonprofit corporation, and there's no way I can make that we're a political subdivision.
I think long and hard. I don't think I can get home on that.
No. So that was the second area. And then the third area on Prop A was where the court decided against us, all three judges. You know, the case presents problems. I expect that there will be further appeals to the Supreme Court, and we'll see if the Supreme Court accepts them. I would expect them to. These are tremendously important issues. And I think it's important. I think if the court focuses on the text and can put aside, which is often hard for courts to do, politics, I think we have a strong chance of winning all three at the Supreme Court. You know, it's easier to say put aside politics. I don't mean that in any underhanded way.
It's just
way.
The reality of the world in which we play in, yeah.
Right. We all have politics, even when we don't necessarily aren't invoking them or think we're invoking them. But to interpret a constitution, it takes a lot of discipline to separate those things out, you know, and that's what we would be asking the court to do.
I mean, in hindsight, we should have probably filed this, you know, 30 years ago before. I think that's part of what we face now, right? It's such so much time has passed and it's such a big issue now. It isn't going to be a difficult decision, I think, for them to come home on.
No question, you know, and you're right. The passage of time validates something that was clearly invalid, right?
Well, you know, and I mean, I work for the league and I have for a long time now, but, you know, I used to be on the other side of the fence working directly for local government. And it is one of those things where you feel like it's worse than David and Goliath. You sort of feel like, well, what are you going to do? And you go about your business. And I think the one thing that's really changed is we had a system that worked better 1,000 years ago when I was still doing that. And it's so broken now that it sort of has created the crisis that we've maybe needed all along to say, this is nonsense. This is not how this was supposed to work. And we need to step forward and try to do something about that.
I think that's very true. And I think that's where, you know, the passage of time has also highlighted the problems.
Absolutely.
Because it's gotten to a point where I think there's widespread recognition that there's a real problem here. It's not a problem that's just going to go away with a, you know, wouldn't we just turn our heads and look the other way? It's a problem that needs addressed. And we hopefully, you know, the court's aware of that as well.
So what is the status now? The decision came out in terms of filing appeals. I think the state at one point had filed a motion. I forget what that motion was.
Well, you were stuck in sort of a limbo pattern. It's technical, legal, procedural matters, but what it is after the decision came down, the state filed a motion for reconsideration, essentially asking the court, hey,
are you sure about this?
Exactly. It's an are you sure about this?
My kid
motion.
Does that as well. Yeah, he filed about his reconsideration motion.
We're awaiting a decision on that. It's very rare that those are granted, unless there's new facts that were discovered.
Yeah, I was going to say, what would be the basis of that? Just like, oh, now that you asked again, yeah, I got it wrong? Or
usually there's new facts or the court above made a new decision after the original briefs were submitted. Neither is the circumstances in this case.
Gotcha.
This is just more or less a case that says, we think you got it wrong. Could you think about it again?
Okay.
Those are very rarely granted. So, but we'll see.
So when will they rule on that motion?
It's there's no set time period. And I do think maybe perhaps the state budget issues may, you know, in that I do know different departments are gearing up for potential shutdown or trying to think through it. And so I don't know how the caseload looks with the Court of Appeals, whether they're
so the timeline to decide whether to appeal the decision doesn't start until that motion's ruled on.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And so that's what we're waiting on right now.
Okay, so the I'm playing, just trying to get my own knowledge up to speed here. You don't file the appeal on necessarily any one of those counts. You file it on the whole thing? Is that
yes,
how that works?
Okay. Traditionally, it's when the whole case is ended. They used to do it the way where separate issues might come up, but courts have gone away from the idea of doing those sort of piecemeal appeals. They'd rather look at it all at once.
Well, I tell you, I've been watching this really closely, and I've said this before. I think when you guys first filed this, it was like, well, this is kind of cool, but, you know, there's really I don't see this going very far. And as it's developed over time, really been impressed with the way you guys have presented these arguments. As you point out, I think half of the battle is taking this giant, complicated thing that very few people pay attention to and trying to make it into arguments that people can digest and understand. I think you guys have done a great job doing that. And I think for that reason, this thing has continued to move the way it has. And I'm kind of excited to see what happens, assuming the Supreme Court will hear the appeal. Because when you look at the merits of it and you think about the arguments you guys are putting forward, they're pretty straightforward and it's kind of hard to argue with. And I like you, think this has as much to do with politics as it does with any legal analysis of the facts, because the facts seem to, when you kind of look at them, from just a common sense perspective, seem to lean our way.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And particularly, courts have moved to the idea of plain language. And when you start looking at the plain language, this is a case where you have light bulb moments. And once you get it, you're like, that's pretty plain. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get much clearer than that.
Yeah.
The politics of it is funny because it's one of the unusual cases that I've had where it's hard to say what any individual would come down. The Headley Amendment was part of the conservative movement and strongly supported by conservative folks. And then the folks for, greater funding, let's say, of schools and whatnot tends to be, the other side of the aisle. So we have a very interesting mixture of support for this case that you don't often see in many cases.
Yeah.
And we've had great work. It has been I think you're aware, but other folks should be aware that very much it's been a sort of volunteer effort in that we don't have any dedicated funding for this case. We don't get any specific funding. Steve Duchesne, who's ran the Taxpayers for Michigan Constitutional Government, along with Professor Moak, really got this going on their own and pulled in folks. They've raised some money now to help with costs. But then Tracy Peters, an attorney, is doing this solely on her own time, and same with Sarah Candell. But I think it's a case that, when you begin to understand, too, you realize this does impact everyone.
And not just cities. I mean, when they say local government, it's cities, it's schools. I mean, it's
absolutely
a lot at stake here.
Right.
And getting it right, I think, is very important.
Right. All these authorities, your water authorities, if you're wondering why you're getting assessed, storm drainage fees and connection fees that you may not have seen before, or business inspection fees. It's because cities are pressed on how to raise revenue and, they're forced into these sort of creative alternatives to do that. And this case seeks to alleviate some of that.
Yeah. I just want to thank you for all the work you've done and the whole coalition that's come together to work in this. This is very important stuff. And I'm excited to see where this goes. And hopefully we'll have you back in a few months here talking about the big victory that you got and arguing before the Supreme Court and all that.
I'm hoping the same as well, Tony. And awesome. I really do appreciate all the support that we've gotten from folks.
Awesome. Well, thanks again. I really appreciate coming on.
Thank you.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org and join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.